Hi everyone, welcome to a special edition of the podcast where The Lancet Voice is joining forces with the Race and Health podcast. My name is Dilan Devakumar and I'm a Professor of Global Child Health and a Public Health Consultant in University College London. For those of you who don't know, The Lancet Voice is produced by The Lancet Journal and seeks to unravel stories behind the best global health, policy and clinical research of the day and what it means for people around the world. The Race and Health podcast explores racism, xenophobia and discrimination and how they affect health, particularly focusing on power systems and how they shape unequal health outcomes. I'm the usual host of the Race and Health podcast, and today we're going to talk about the new Lancet series on racism, xenophobia and discrimination and health. And this is a series that I'm leading, which is being published on the 8th of December, 2022, within a special issue called Advancing Racial and Ethnic Equity in Science, Medicine and Global Health. I'm joined today by three wonderful guests and co-authors on the series. Professor Tendai Achiume, who is the inaugural Alice Mignana Professor of Law and the former UN Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia and Related Intolerance. We've got Dr. Sujitha Selvaraja, one of the founders of Race and Health and an obstetrics and gynecology registrar in the UK. And finally, Dr. Gideon Lasco, who's a physician and medical anthropologist and senior lecturer at the University of the Philippines. Nice to see you all. Can I start by asking you all what racism means to you on a more personal level? What does it mean to you?
Thanks so much, Dilan, and it's really a pleasure to be here with this group, and it's a pleasure to have collaborated with all of you on this project. You know, it's in some ways really hard to think of one snapshot that captures what racism means to me, but I suppose the thing I'm thinking the most about right now is that I have a toddler who will be racialized as Black in the United States. And I think one of the things racism means to me is fearing for his life in encounters with law enforcement and even encounters with private citizens on account of the color of the skin and feeling entirely powerless over that.
Thank you. Sujitha.
But I guess in terms of what racism means to me, it gives me context. You know, I'm sat here in my room in South London, but it kind of explains to me a lot about why and how I'm here. My family, before I was born, they fled a civil war where they were persecuted for their identity. That identity, it can be categorized as race or ethnicity, but being Tamil meant that they weren't safe. My mum has told me the stories of her holding my young sister on her hip and trying to walk through across her road, but there are missiles coming, but she's just found out her dad has died and she's in the middle of war with a new child on her hip. And that's a reality that I can't quite imagine, but that's the reason why they left, right? For a place of safety. And when they're leaving, they're thinking, right, where is going to give us safety and opportunity? And it's a country that has built its wealth through colonialism, through extraction. And so it kind of makes sense that that's why I'm here now. So I guess for me, racism gives me a sense of context, but also a great sense of a feeling of injustice.
Thank you. Gideon?
Yeah, for me personally, racism is having to carry a burden of proof for what's important, as opposed to just enjoying a presumption of value and dignity that befits every human being. This burden of proof can manifest in having to show your ID when you're doing a credit card purchase. It can be an inconvenience like that. That where's your ID? As if I am more of a risk for fraud than the person in front of me who is different. I think it can be a burden of proof for some inconveniences in life, but it can also be a burden of proof for the right to live itself. And we've seen this many times in my own country, in the Philippines, where we have a large global diaspora. And so people all over the world face different threats from violence in workplaces to anti-Asian hate in the US. So it's many things in different situations. But what they have in common, I think, is this burden of proof that can be sometimes insurmountable.
Thank you. And thank you to all of you for giving that sort of personal input, because we talk in very abstract conceptual terms within the series, but racism means something very personal. For me, it's very similar to yours, Sujitha, in that it's broadly two things. It's growing up as a young South Asian boy in the UK, but also my family history from Sri Lanka, religious ethnic conflict, and being a little bit older than you, I remember some of this, and we had just left. It shaped my family's history in a big way. So yeah, thank you for doing that. Can I ask, maybe Sujitha, this question to you is, why is racism important as a topic for health? Why should we talk about this?
Yeah, I think when we understand racism, I think lots of people have got different definitions of it, right? But if we understand racism as a system, quite an all-encompassing system that exists everywhere, that affords power and privilege to some and not to others, in accordance with a hierarchy, those processes that are so pervasive affect the way that we live, affect everyone. The way that we live, how we live, will inform every institution, every system that governs our society. And so in doing that, there's so much of that that affects health. We know that so much of health is determined well before somebody goes to a hospital, well outside of healthcare systems. So to have something that is so pervasive, of course it's going to affect health. Of course it's going to contribute to ill health and inequities. That feels like common sense almost. So the fact that it's been so ignored and kind of sidelined and never really been center place in global health, in public health, I think that's kind of testament to kind of how racism and discrimination operates.
Thank you. Thank you. And I think that's a very good segue into the series and why we're doing this. So let's talk about the series. This has been a long time brewing. It started pre-COVID, and my aims before the series started were to raise the profile of racism, xenophobia, so that they are considered public health priorities, because they are, as you say, relatively ignored. And, you know, Gideon Sujitha, especially to you, you may be different, but when I used to take a clinical history, I didn't ask about the discrimination that someone faces. I didn't, you know, think about that, whether it be interpersonal or structural. And that's something I want clinicians to think about when they are taking histories. Secondly, I think this is a global health issue, that this is something where similar processes happen in every society, everywhere. And there are similar discriminatory ideologies, whether they're based on race or ethnicity, caste, indigenous status, migratory status, religion, skin color. There are very similar things going on in terms of causes and the health outcomes. And finally, that this is a structural problem, that we think about acts of violence, we think about verbal abuse, but we usually don't think about what happens and what lies underneath the root causes of this. So what we did was to write four papers, and we'll go through each one in turn. The first one covering the history and politics, the second one health outcomes, third one looking case study, take intersectional approach, and the fourth one focusing on interventions. So Tindai, can you tell us about the first paper, just to describe what's in it and some of the important messages, please?
Sure. So the first paper sets the tone for the rest of the series. It provides a conceptual framework and provides historical, political, and legal background for how we should be thinking about racism and its relationship to public health. So very often, I think our tendency is to think of racism as being solely about prejudice and about explicitly expressed prejudice. But what we articulate in the paper is the ways in which race has operated as an organizing principle in many ways, a mechanism for creating global hierarchies according to which some people and some places are designated inferior or superior. And we say in the paper that we're looking at race, but we're also looking at ethnicity, we're looking at indigeneity, looking at caste, and we're looking at all of these categories that are based on two moves, essentially, which is the separation of different people and power hierarchies that are then layered over those separations. And so paper situates the present in the past and really outlines the way that historical legacies of racism and discrimination continue to shape the way that race and racism operate today, whether we're thinking about the caste system in the Indian subcontinent, whether we're thinking about the historical treatment of Jews, or whether we're thinking specifically about the relationship between race and colonialism and the way that race operated in the colonial era to designate life chances for different groups and how that continues in the present. We highlight in the paper as well the way that contemporary politics, so the rise in ethno-nationalism, right-wing ethno-nationalism, xenophobic scapegoating of refugees and asylum seekers, and different sorts of political currents that actually exacerbate racism and xenophobia also end up manifesting or shaping the ways in which people experience health and health outcomes as well. And as a lawyer, I was really thrilled that the, not just the first paper, but the series in general, I think takes seriously the way that law and policy can operate for good. They have a very important role to play in terms of combating racism and xenophobia and improving health outcomes. But law itself and policy itself can sometimes be on the wrong side. And law and policy, even laws and policies that seem facially neutral, can have the effect of reinforcing racist or xenophobic outcomes in ways that impact public health. And I was rereading the series and thinking in particular about the environment and environmental conditions, because climate is really on people's minds right now. And when we think about the kinds of laws that designate where different groups live, where, you know, toxic industries that emit pollution are located, many of those are located in parts of the world and even in neighborhoods and cities where minoritized groups dominate. And so we see how law and policy can shape health outcomes, even in ways that aren't necessarily anchored in the explicit racism that we think of front and center. So to my mind, those are some of the important dynamics that are set up in the first paper.
Thank you. And I think on that particular point, the Race and Health podcast, we've had a series on environmental racism that gets into some of those issues. I know Lancet Voice had an episode on strategic litigation, focusing on the environment as well. Before I come to you, Sujitha, someone asked me the question, why now? And of course, it isn't why now, because this has been going on for years and centuries. But has there been anything that you think has changed in recent times?
So the why now question is a really important question to ask. And you're right, racism and xenophobia are not new, and their impact on public health and health outcomes in general are also not new. But I think prior to 2020, in many parts of the world, the framing or understanding of all race of xenophobia was out of, you know, marginality. These are marginal issues. And I think that speaks to the marginalization of the groups that are most harmed by racism and xenophobia. But in 2020, I think the kind of confluence of the racial justice uprisings globally, which I think made it difficult to avoid conversations about systemic racism in all fields, you know, not just in law enforcement, even though that's where the conversations began. I think there was just an opening for a kind of openness to understanding exactly what racial subordination looks like now. And then COVID, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic, and it's just very clear racial and ethnic impact, I think also, and that dynamic globally, I think also put on the table in very real ways conversations about race and xenophobia that previously had been marginalized. So I see 2020 as marking a moment across borders where we were forced to confront dynamics that are typically pushed to the side because of the way that power operates in society. And I think we're in a moment where, while we have this attention, we have to think about how we change society and how we change systems and structures, lest we go back in the next 2 years again to a world where it's difficult to have conversations about race and xenophobia like the ones that we're having.
Thank you. Gideon, Sujitha, anything to add on that?
I fully agree that it's a confluence of different factors, the pandemic, all of these events that we're seeing, the toxic confluence of politics, and also how even the climate crisis is being experienced along lines of discrimination and racism, and that it's also inseparable with health, the environment. But at the same time, I also want to highlight that it's also thanks to the efforts of activists and advocates around the world that have really insisted that this will happen, that we need to have a reckoning of racism in health, that we are talking about it now. So I would like to pay tribute also to all of these academics who have, and also activists who paved the way for this moment to actually happen.
Absolutely, yes. Sujitha, tell us about the conceptual model that comes into paper one, but frames the whole series, because you're the brains behind this model.
When we're talking about things like structural discrimination or structural racism, I think sometimes it can feel like almost like an ephemeral concept. You can't quite grasp it. What does that mean? If we woke up tomorrow and there was not a single person on this planet was no longer racist, the world would still be structurally racist, right? To kind of show that it's not necessarily reliant on individuals for it to persist and to exert its effects. So in terms of kind of visualizing this, lots of times when people think about racism and discrimination, they tend to think about things on a one-to-one level. They're trying to think about, you know, police brutality at an individual level, that face-to-face level. And that feels quite something that we can kind of comprehend. But if we kind of think about the visualization of the earth, that's what the framework refers to, and we think about humanity and communities existing on the surface level, that kind of one-to-one interaction is exactly that. It's the superficial manifestation of so much more that's happening. And so at the core of how discrimination and how racism and xenophobia operate is structural discrimination. And then at the heart of that are two things. One, this concept of separation, which came from an Indigenous collective in Canada called Gesturing Towards Decolonial Futures, the Musqueam community. And the idea that separation being humans thinking that we are different individuals, separate from one another, separate from the environment in which we exist, and separate from kind of different communities. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that of hierarchical power structures that govern our society. So if we think of that as the core, there's lots of things. Institutions don't all of a sudden come up and become racist. There's historical context that places that kind of explains why that is. These ladders that have been created where those at the top are afforded power and privilege and health and those at the bottom aren't, those have been created by, you know, colonialism, neoliberalism, racial capitalism, the existence of these caste hierarchies that have been created. And so that kind of explains why institutions and systems have been created and why they exist how they are. And so when you're thinking about that in relation to health, health systems are, of course, affected by that. The way in which all these complex processes are going to affect an individual and affect their health is going to be determined by where they are. What are the policies? What the laws and where you're living? Who are the communities that are nearby? And that kind of brings in this layer of spatial determination that where you are will determine how all those core processes, how all those institutions and systems affect your health. And then that you're looking at individuals within communities, whether that's communities that are brought together by some sort of connectedness, right? Whether that's identity or location or shared interest, that will affect an individual's health. And then finally, when we're looking at individuals, kind of breaking it down into three things, actually responses to all of these complex processes. These things are behavioral responses. So behavioral responses to discrimination can relate to your physical activity, your sleep patterns. Then the second being psychological responses. So it might be internalizing racism. It might be internalizing these ladders that have told you you're not worthy of being at the top. You're not worthy of that power. And then very important to health, the physiological responses to discrimination. So that is related to stress, the daily stress of discrimination and how that can affect your health. The last thing is to do with time. The way that discrimination affects health is also related to the life course and how there's a cumulative impact of discrimination and how there's intergenerational impacts as well.
Thank you. And before we go into these health outcomes, which is largely the second paper, Tendai, get in any thoughts?
I was just going to say that I think what's helpful about the model is that the conceptual model, that it does have a visualization that brings together ways of understanding what racism is and does in different disciplines and different areas of life, but kind of brings them together to kind of give us a synthetic account of how we should be thinking about racism and xenophobia in relation to public health. So to me, I think the best thing about the model is also the best thing about the collaboration. You all, I think, are predominantly in the field of public health. I'm in the field of law. And in different fields and in different areas of life, people are thinking and talking about the impact of race and xenophobia on their lives. And health is a very central part of our lives. But we often are not using language that makes it easy to conceptualize across those boundaries. And I find the model to very helpfully bring together different ways and different levels, scales, you know, geographies and even temporalities, how we're thinking about racism and its impact on our lives. So that I found that helpful. And maybe I'm an insider and I've drunk from the same fountain that you have, Sujitha, so it makes it less compelling, but it's one of the things I really appreciated about it and about the collaboration.
Thank you. And the other thing I like about it is that it flips the usual structural determinants model that we have in health, public health, in that the person is very small on the outside of the model, and the central kind of structural causes are what's driving ill health or good health. Okay, so Sujitha, following on from the conceptual model, can you tell us a bit more about paper two, please?
Sure. From an academic point of view, we did a scoping review. We're trying to map these pathways of discrimination that we've just explained onto health outcomes. So in terms of that third thing at an individual level, looking at physiology and behaviours and psychology, what are the health outcomes that are essentially manifestations at an individual level of racism and discrimination? And the results of our scoping review is overwhelming. It's both overwhelming and an underestimate, both at the same time. So we have categorized these health outcomes in terms of mental health, sexual and reproductive health, non-communicable diseases, looked at mortality. And we've also looked at separated those across the life course. And what you find is that discrimination affects health outcomes across all ages, across all aspects, all areas of the world, and it continues to do so across the life course. So we know that someone who's pregnant who experiences discrimination, there's evidence to suggest that if you check the blood level, the cortisol level, the stress hormone of their child at 6 weeks, that's going to be higher compared to someone who did not experience discrimination when they were pregnant. We also know that there is associations between discrimination when someone's pregnant with they're less likely to breastfeed, which is then associated with that child more likely to be obese, that child more likely to develop type 1 and type 2 diabetes. There's a higher risk of infectious diseases to the baby. There's associations between discrimination and mortality. That one exists all across the life course. That happens in childhood, in adulthood, in older adults. And there's associations between discrimination and type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure. All these things that kind of understand it in the context of the framework, it makes sense. But there's evidence that we have looked at that supports this. And I guess the question is, you know, we're saying that it's overwhelming and also an underestimate, is that there is enough evidence to act. That's the main thing to say. Yes, we need to be conducting more research and we need to have a greater understanding and particularly a greater nuanced understanding of how and where this is happening. There's definitely enough to. So I think that's one of the key things that comes out of paper two. There's a specific focus on stress and the allostatic load. And this is that day-to-day discrimination has epigenetic changes. So there's changes in how our body. So if we think of input, I think of this as inputs and outputs. So outputs are health outcomes. Inputs are experiences of discrimination. And then our body is the machinery that kind of processes that input to that out. And in terms of how our body responds to that, is that it's in this fight or flight mechanism, right? Which is an adaptive process. Our bodies were designed to do that to kind of protect ourselves. But actually in the context of day-to-day discrimination, which could be, you know, uncertainty about your job, been made redundant, all of these day-to-day stresses that is related to discrimination relates to this thing called allostatic load and weathering, where actually you're aging a lot earlier than you would. And you're also more likely to develop these chronic conditions such as raised blood pressure and type 2 diabetes. And that's a kind of a key way in kind of understanding this input of discrimination and this output of poor health and health inequity.
Thank you. So what we get is this sort of overload of the system, this hormonal imbalances. And you mentioned epigenetics, so this idea that the environment can influence the expression of your DNA without changing the DNA itself. Gideon, as a doctor and physician, these kind of concepts, are they there in your normal practice or not?
Yeah, they're definitely not discussed at all in medical school. At least when I was studying medicine in the Philippines, there's really, looking back now from the lens that we have, from the benefit of all the insights that we have now, we see how our medical education has been largely based on textbooks from the US, without much reflexivity on how, in fact, what we learn, this kind of knowledge that's taken for granted as fact, it's influenced by so many factors, including discrimination. And it's surprising coming from a global South country like the Philippines that there's lack of reflexivity around these issues. And I think that Sujita was already talking about one of the things that can be done. And definitely it has to include how our curriculum, not just in medical schools, but in all kinds of health fields and also in social sciences has to be reflected in terms of what these impacts are. Because you cannot just look at a medical condition and think that this is something that universal. The specificity, the diversity of human experience has to be reflected in the way we think about medicine.
Thank you. And just to describe the third paper of the series, so this paper has a series of case studies from around the world. And what I really wanted to do with this one is to show how there are similar things happening in different parts of the world, all over the world. And we covered the legal prison system in Brazil, Islamophobia affecting people in Europe and North America, maternal and child health care in India in relation to the caste system, indigeneity in Australia, and xenophobia on a background of apartheid in South Africa. And this paper in particular takes an intersectional approach that considers abilities and disabilities, gender, socioeconomic status, and many other factors, and brings them together in this analysis. And Tendai, maybe you can come in at that point, because I know you've traveled and worked in many different places, particularly your former role as UN Rapporteur. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So, you know, in my work as Special Rapporteur, one of the things that I did was conduct country visits. So actually visit different countries and speak to government officials, speak to different groups who are racially or ethnically marginalized in order to form a picture for how well racial equality and racial justice norms were being implemented. And before I took on the role, I imagined that I'm not sure what kind of conception I had, but I was actually surprised by what I found. So one thing I found, which I think really resonates with what you're describing, which is that the way that racism and xenophobia manifest in different contexts can vary very different, can vary greatly. So the experiences of racism and xenophobia in Qatar, for example, which is one country that I visited, versus in the United Kingdom, you know, it's the histories, the context that are shaping the way that people are experiencing health or any other system varies. But what was uniform was that irrespective of where I visited, there was some kind of hierarchy or some kind of system that placed certain groups at the top and at the bottom on the basis of racialization involved using, you know, how they look, how they talk, how they sound. And so I think the work that is done in the series, both to try and tell a story that is, you know, universal in the sense of applicable in many different places, but then it also pays attention to case studies that looks at specific context, I think is really important, both for giving us a diagnosis that emphasizes that this is a challenge irrespective of where we are, but then how we think about responding has to be very much tailored to the unique and specific context. I think to me that double move is what comes out of the way that the papers in the series are arranged. And I think it's really important.
Yeah. And the other side of this is that the health outcomes, so as public health or clinical doctors, we see similar health outcomes from these different groups who might be persecuted, marginalized in different ways. There are similar non-communicable diseases, issues with someone's mental health, issues in perinatal health, as you described, Sujitha.
One quick thing I would add is that, you know, in those country visits and in the consultations with minoritized groups, with refugees, asylum seekers, you know, they all report experiences of racism and xenophobia in accessing healthcare. So even though I like to think about explicit prejudice and all of these sorts of things as not doing all of the work, many of the people I consulted with spoke very vividly, and in some cases, they were actually told that they were being given lower quality treatment because of the way they looked and the way that they spoke. But on the other hand, in speaking to government officials, there was deep levels of disbelief that this kind of a thing was taking place. And I think showing that there's differences in health outcomes and having that be in, you know, a scientific journal, I think goes a long way to validating what many people who experience racial discrimination know about the treatment that they're receiving. So Gideon, you mentioned earlier the role of advocates and activists in getting us to a point where we can have this conversation. I think that work is so important side by side with interventions that show, you know, from a scientific perspective, how outcomes are actually, how outcomes are being affected. Because many times the people who know this to be their life experience don't have a way of making the case that that is their life experience when they're in contexts where decisions can be made that would actually result in different outcomes.
Thank you. And, you know, we see this here in the UK. The UK has a national health system, but it isn't, there are different barriers to access for migrants in particular. Gideon, on to the fourth paper, and if you can talk a little bit about interventions and what we might do and things at work.
Yes, thank you. So building on the three papers, what the fourth paper set to do was to survey various levels of intervention. And we ended up finding, I think, 89 papers that fit our search criteria in terms of papers, broadly construed that actually try to deal with or to document interventions that have been done. And we saw that there's a skew towards individual and community level intervention. Mostly, one example, is children being showed films, anti-racist films, and then trying to measure what they felt like afterwards. So there were many of these studies. But we saw that there's much less in terms of interventions looking at health systems, institutions, social movements, and legal and human rights frameworks, even though there's great potential in those interventions. For example, we saw that human rights interventions have had various impacts on health outcomes, ranging from tuberculosis in South Africa to health insurance in Colombia, as well as HIV-related outcomes all over the world. The U.S. civil rights movement and affirmative action to support minoritized castes in India. We also saw some studies that show how these broad movements, social movements, have led to reductions in infant or child mortality. So more broadly, if you take all of these works together and we point out, we express frustration in the paper that there's so limited literature around these topics. And that's the first thing that we highlight as a conclusion, is that there's been very little and we need more in-depth research that explores specific discrimination-based issues in healthcare, explicitly around health, and examines how these interventions operate at different levels. We look at the individual, the community, the social movements, institutions, and of course, even frameworks like legal frameworks. And we also know that the overwhelming number of these studies tend to be in countries like the U.S. And even within the U.S., there's been little work on racism and xenophobia as concerned particular communities, like the East and Southeast Asian communities, for example. So we need more country-focused papers. And also building on the conclusions of the earlier three papers, the most important thing, one of the most important things in the paper is that it really creates a case for more transformative action to address the structural drivers of racial injustice.
Thank you. And maybe Tendai, if I can come back to you, because those kind of legal interventions seem to be, at least from my perspective, some of the ones that are the most effective. And you wrote a lot of that section.
yes. So, you know, I think what was exciting about doing the research on this section was actually seeing that there were contexts where shifts in law and policy had actually made a concrete difference on the ground. And Gideon kind of spoke to this. And, you know, in international human rights, for example, we have a framework that is about promoting racial equality and doing so also in the context of health. And part of that framework is about affirmative action. So, you know, specific steps that are taken by governments to address racial inequality by providing resources and kind of legislative interventions that seek to lift groups that have been racially discriminated against to kind of, you know, ensure that they also access equality. And so it was really reassuring from somebody who studies the law to see that these interventions make a difference. I think what was really disheartening, and this is echoed in what Gideon was saying, is that there isn't every place where we have these legal interventions, we don't necessarily have studies that are showing us what their impacts are. So in parts of the world like South Africa and parts of the world like the United States, where resources are being, you know, devoted to these sorts of studies, we have a lot of information. But in other parts of the world, we do not. And even though, as we've mentioned on this podcast, we can think of racism and xenophobia as affecting many parts of the world, context matters and local context matters, even in the way that laws and policies have their effect. And so I think one of the takeaways from the series and from doing the research is that we need more research, not because we don't think law can have an impact, but the nature of that impact is going to be contingent on factors that depend on the context that you are in. It was also remarkable to me in doing the research for this that in many of the spaces where policymaking is taking place and where human rights are being translated and being implementable at the local level, those conversations are dominated by lawyers, you know, and other types who don't necessarily have the public health background that, say, you all have. And that has to be essential, I think, to thinking about how you make human rights real in very local contexts. So just in terms of thinking about takeaways and key directions we want to go going forward, one of them is thinking about how we disrupt the disciplinary silos that mean that law and policy making is taking place in one area, and then those people who are working on actually measuring or delivering health outcomes are sort of taking place in a different area. One other thing in thinking about the final paper in the series and the recommendations that we make, one thing that is especially valuable is I think that the series is oriented towards actionable items that are sort of digestible, but I think is also ambitious in situating the entire project where we start by saying, if what we're interested in is different kinds of health outcomes, more equitable kinds of outcomes, we have to be thinking about decolonization, for example, and what the project of decolonization is in the context of public health. You know, and for many people, decolonization can feel like a call to something either that's already happened or something that's very amorphous. But I think the final paper really attempts to concretize that and say part of what we're trying to do is shift the way we understand the way that race operates in society. And that is a decolonial project in the parts of the world where that has been shaped by decolonization. So just the ambition of some of the recommendations, I think, matches nicely with some of the concrete proposals that are provided. And we haven't spoken as much in our conversation about intersectionality, even though intersectionality very deeply informed the entire drafting, you know, paper one, paper two, paper three, and paper four. But that's one of the recommendations in the final paper as well, to say we have to take intersectionality seriously. And an intersectionality that moves beyond thinking that just means thinking about women and thinking about cis women and cis white women, to be specific, really thinking about intersectionality as bringing together complicated ways of thinking about race, ethnicity, gender, disability status, and how all of these things shape the kinds of health outcomes that we're thinking about as well.
Thank you. And thank you to all of you for describing this massive amount of work in such a short time. My final question to you is just, what is your take-home message for the listener to the podcast?
Well, despite all the heavy challenges that lie ahead, I think that series actually give me hope, because some interventions have actually worked, and there are people who are working to document these. There are people who have not given up, and in fact are trying in different levels, from the individual to the institutional to the structural, to address this. And we can take strength from that, and we can build on those. Knowing, for example, that, as Tendai said, that legal frameworks actually matter. These are not just pieces of paper that politicians sign, and we can actually use them to make certain demands for minoritized people. These are important sources of encouragement, and I think that it should inspire us to continue this work in all different places, with an intersectional mindset, but also with some encouragement that we can actually try to make a world a less dangerous place for people who are experiencing xenophobia and discrimination and racism.
Thank you. Sujitha.
Thank you. I think I think mapping racism and discrimination to health outcomes is quite powerful because there's something so palpable, so real about health outcomes. There's something about health and ill health that everyone can relate to and that feels like a measurable outcome, something very tangible. And more specifically for those within health, when for so long we have been taught all these health outcomes, various cancers, cardiovascular disease, lung disease, diabetes, blood pressure. For so long, we have been taught, you will see on one side is your modifiable risk factors and your non-modifiable risk factors. And we have been taught that race and minoritized ethnicities and indigeneities are your non-modifiable risk factors for all of these health outcomes. But what this series does is it rejects this genetic basis of it and instead proposes a framework for showing actually, fine, if it's not genetics, what is it? And this is a vast model. There are so many pathways. And also everyone is implicated, so everyone can do something about it. And I think actually, if we believe instead that this relationship between ill health and race and ethnicity and minoritized people is not that it's non-modifiable, it's in fact modifiable. And actually the onus is on every single one of us to modify that risk. That actually should feel quite empowering. There's something we've been told that's inevitable that we're now thinking actually we can do something about it. I think actually embodying that belief, whether that's on a one-to-one basis, whether that's with every patient that you see that's from a minoritized background, or whether that's you organizing and changing guidelines at your local practice or working across disciplines, seeing how you can change things in law, in culture, I think all of that contributes towards making a difference.
Wonderful. Thank you. Tendai, last word to you.
So it's hard to think about what the last word is, but I think I agree a lot with what both Sitita and Gideon have said, and in some ways it makes it easy. I can just say what they said is exactly what I think should be the last word. But, you know, I think about my own education, and Gideon, you were referencing your own education, and this is a podcast of kind of elite educated individuals, which is worth marking because I think the spaces that we move in often are the spaces that are shaping law and policy, you know, and decisions that are being made in many of the spaces that we care about. In many of these spaces, education around racism and xenophobia and the way that it shapes society just doesn't exist at all. And that feels unconscionable. And I think what's exciting about this series and even the Lancet Commission on kind of race and health, which I know is scheduled, is that it gives everybody who is in a role of educating a resource to be able to start having those conversations around the ways in which racism and xenophobia shape health outcomes. So I would say one thing I would hope, which is very concrete, is for those of you who are listening, who are educators, that you really deploy the series as a resource to really shift the way that we are shaping how people come in to understanding their own role in these fields' relationship to racism and xenophobia in society. So this is the educator in me saying the series just offers, I think, a very helpful and neat way to start conversations that otherwise can be really difficult to have, especially in spaces where conversations about race are taboo, which quite frankly remains many, many, many spaces.
So thank you very much to all of you for joining me and to the Lancet Voice podcast for hosting this. If you like this, do check out and follow the Race and Health and the Lancet Voice podcasts. And if you want something a little different, also check out my other podcast, Global Health Lives, where I talk to people in global health about themselves and their work. Thank you very much, and see you next time.